Michael Nicholson, Reel 4.
Yes, well, from Nigeria, I went back to London and then back into what was then called Biafra, which was the Igbo land, the eastern province of Federal. A country that was run by a man called Ajuku. And the idea was that they should establish their own nation because they were a separate people. Because there are three people in Nigeria. There's the Yoruba in the central area, Lagos. There's the Hausa in the north, Arabic north. And then in the south is the Igbo. And they wanted a breakaway because they were a separate nation. Of course, what it was all about was oil. They had the oil. And they wanted to keep it to themselves. And of course, without the oil, Nigeria would be even poorer than it is. So that was Biafra. But we were all seduced. Every journalist I've ever known who ever went there was quite seduced by Biafra. It had all, you know, it had all the trappings. An infant nation under threat. But the greatest weapon it had was its children. And it used its children to wonderful effect, wonderful propaganda effect. It employed a very efficient a public relations a machine called Mark Press of Geneva, who again saw the how the children could be exploited. The other member of the triangle was the Catholic Church, Caritas, whose missionaries were in there, of course, inside Biafra and doing astonishing work. And so they had a very good reason to join this triumvirate. And they exploited the children too. The fathers, the priests out there, were astonishing propagandists. And took us to these camps. I think it was the first, well, it was certainly the first televisual famine. Nobody in Britain or elsewhere, come to that, had ever seen a famine on television. Biafra was the first and possibly the worst ever televisual famine. There are very few people who are not of our age will remember the children with bloated bellies and legs the thickness of my thumb, strutting about the camps trying to keep alive, not in their dozens, but in their thousands, and Igbo land wide, Biafra wide, hundreds of thousands. You know, it was true that these children in their thousands were dying every year anyway, with or without the war, because of the way Nigeria was being run. But the war certainly made it worse. But for us, of course, the children were being used as a propaganda weapon. They are the most potent image in a war, the children suffering. And, you know, we played our part, as every journalist and every television cameraman did, in promoting them as a propaganda weapon. We felt sorry for them. And it was a degree of our naivety that we didn't realize how well we were being used by Mark Press, by Caritas, and by the priests themselves. Michael Docherney was the man who looked after us. We stayed with Father Byrne, Father John Byrne, in his little mission station. But Michael Docherney was the man who took us around. He was a kind of Spencer Tracy type. He was a Spencer Tracy lookalike. He was a tough Irishman, grey hair, lantern jawed, steely eyed. And I don't think he at the time knew quite what he was being asked to do. I think he just saw us there as a people who could tell his story, that these children... I remember going to Owerri, big camp, where they hadn't had proper food for months. And as we entered the camp with my cameraman Alan Downs and my sound recordist Michael, they started singing, these children, as best they could. But Africans sing at the drop of a sixpence, I mean. Nothing comes more natural. Nothing sounds more grand. And they all crowded around our boxes as we were undoing our camera. Because when they saw that we weren't bringing in food but cameras, there was silence. Terrible, terrible silence. Absolutely ghastly. And then we spent that time filming them. And images which, of course, nobody who'd ever filmed them or seen them on the screen will ever forget. The first television family, the first time we brought these scenes of horror into somebody's front parlour. And while we were there, we were attacked by the federal MiGs. They swooped into her mafia, blew up the petrol dump, attacked the hospital, and we filmed all this. I remember afterwards we went to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital and they were just laying the dead outside the front door. I remember there was three little kiddies. I imagine they were the same family. They were all dressed in much the same kind of clothes. Their eyes were open. And somebody, another Biafran, came along, and I suppose, thinking it would look good for the television camera, leant over and put their little hands together. And we closed their eyes, and we didn't film them. But there was a lot of that. But very powerful images, and it kept the war going. Because had it not been for us, that war would have ended much sooner. So in the way we thought we were helping, promoting the Biafran cause, showing these images of the starving, kept the Biafran cause alive. Had it not been for us, the Biafran cause would have died much earlier and fewer people would have suffered, but there you are. We are pawns, aren't we?
Yes, you were saying how you were used, but were you not really showing the reality?
We were showing the reality, of course we were, but sometimes if it's a genuine cause, what you're showing, you should show. But this was a carefully manipulated press campaign. I mean, if I went to Ethiopia or Rwanda or Angola, if I suddenly realised that my trip had been organised, facilitated, financed by a public relations company, and I'd pull out. And that was carefully manipulated.
That MiG attack, you know, were you actually there when they attacked?
Oh, yes. Well, we were having lunch, such as it was, with Father Byrne. And suddenly we heard this cannon fire, and we recognised it immediately what it was. And then the Biafrans had their own ACAC batteries, and they started firing. And we rushed out onto the balcony, and there they were. I mean, we had prize seats. We were on the balcony, and they were flying all over us. And I stood in front of the camera and did this, looking back, rather hysterical piece to camera, you know, describing what was happening and looking at my watch. And it was a habit I developed over the years. Every time I was in a kind of panic when things were happening around me, I tended to look at my watch and give the time as if as if it was terribly important to anybody. But, you know, you stop play-acting when things like that happen and you just do and say the first thing that occurs to you. I didn't feel at all frightened.
You didn't?
No, I never have felt frightened. I can honestly say that God is my witness that I've never been afraid in a war. As I think I said in my book, the only time I've ever been afraid in a war is the thought that I might not be sent to it. No, I've never been afraid. I don't know why. People all around me can sometimes be terrified, but I've never had that, you know, that feeling you get when you're about to give a speech in front of lots of people, or you're just about to do a bungee jump or try and ski down a hill when you know that it's a bit too steep for you. You get that nasty little feeling, don't you, in your stomach, and a slight shiver. I've never had that.
Is that because you're excited by it? You know, there's another emotion.
Yes, yes, certainly excited by it. But I've never been scared. I'm not unique that way. You know, I know a lot of people who feel the same way. But I think if I'd been scared, I couldn't have done it so often. I'm often full of despair, thinking, oh God, you know, why have I done this? Frequently I pray, I've made a promise to God or whoever's up there watching me, that if I get out of this, I'll never do it again. And I've broken that promise too many times for him ever to believe it again.
Do you also get frustrated, you know, that the films you've worked so hard to get perhaps don't have that arousing effect on people?
No, it's. I mean, I'm sure you heard this from. You'll hear it from any other war reporter, Kate Adie, Martin Bell, any of them. Will all say that so much of what they've filmed and have risked their life and their cameraman's, their crew's life in getting, is not shown to the public because of some timorous editor back in London, who feels it wouldn't be right or decent and it'd be insensitive, might upset the viewers if they were to see it. And you know, I'm sure you've come across it already, this sanitization of war, the filtering out of suffering, making, to such an extent, you take the suffering out of war, and you make war almost acceptable because it's so well manicured by the editors back home. There's a lot of us who say, show the whole damn lot. When I was in Sarajevo, there was a fair bit of bloodletting there, and we weren't allowed to show it. I was in Sarajevo at the time of the Bread Queue massacre, though I didn't film it because it was all done and gone by the time we got there. But cameramen did film it, and I think it was the Sarajevo camera crews who filmed it. They filmed all the gore of that massacre, where, how was it, 68 people died? Slaughtered by mortar shells, and we weren't allowed to show any part of it except a little bit of, you know, rushing here and rushing there and a quick glimpse of this, children crying, women crying, but none of the carnage. And yet in my movie of my book Welcome to Sarajevo, they showed all of it in actuality. They didn't reconstruct it. They actually just used the entire sequence, showing the torn legs, the open chests, the smashed tent. They showed everything. So, you know, well, how is it you can show it in the movies, but you can't show it on television? But we are governed by editors and producers of the night who have their own agenda. People who I say, using my phrase again, people who are safely distanced from tragedy, and believe they know what is right for the viewer. And as they are the final verdict, you know, there's nothing I can do about it.
I suppose it comes under good taste, doesn't it?
Well, war isn't about good taste, you see. War is about the perfectly bad taste. You don't get a worse taste than war. I think perhaps there are times when there are certain things you can't show, like, for example, the shooting of Eddie Bear. I seem to recollect 9 bullets went into his chest. When Jeffrey Cox, the editor, saw it, as I said, he had to make a decision. Do I show it? Don't I show it? He decided to show it, but he uttered the immortal phrase, stop it on the second bullet. So you see the man killed, but you don't hover on it. And last week, we filmed a farmer watching his prize sheep, who he was very fond of. He was very fond of a particular ram, that his breeding ram, watching them slaughtered. And the man broke down uncontrollably. I've never seen a man weep quite the same way. And he wept and wept and wept. So we couldn't. We had to stop. We filmed him weeping, but we could only transmit the first few seconds of it, because to have dwelt on it would have been bad taste. to watch a person suffering close up, but you had to see the man suffering. And I remember Geoffrey Cox again during the Abba Van. That was another one of my home stories, Abba Van, when 144 teachers and children were covered in that mudslide in Wales. That was my first great tragedy to cover. We then had to cover the funeral of the funeral and the parents going to those funerals. And Geoffrey made the ruling, I do not want those parents to see an ITN cameraman in front of them. And again, one of his immortal phrases, you will cover suffering from behind. And that's what we did. We stood aside, cameras out of the way, until they'd passed, and then we filmed them going away from us. So there are certain rules that you have to obey, and I would be one of the first to obey them. But there are other rules which are frivolous, unnecessary, and in bad taste.
Do you think the squeamishness you were talking about earlier, has that got more so with time? You know, when you think of when you started in the 60s and the situation today, do you think the public are even more protected today than they were earlier on?
I think they probably are. I think they probably are. I wonder if anyone would have shown the Igbo being shot today. Certainly some of the carnage I saw in Vietnam, some of the things we shot there, I wonder whether they would be used today. Don't ask me why. Maybe because I think a lot of it has to do with some of the bosses in the old days were actually once reporters themselves and like me had grown up with something of the tragedy in them. The suits, as we call them now, the suits, the editors, the program makers, our commuter journalists. None of them have ever worked in the field. None of them have been reporters. None of them had first-hand knowledge. None of them have been witness to human tragedy. They only see it in celluloid or they see it in the video. They go to beds, Wimbledon and Esher and Guildford every night. Therefore, their threshold of suffering, their threshold is a great deal lower than mine would be. They are more sensitive because they've seen nothing of it, and if the more you see of it, probably the less sensitive you become to it. Do you see what I'm getting at? I can't think of any other explanation. Maybe the viewer is the same. Maybe the viewer doesn't want to be. And of course, the other thing is that the editors are terrified of the switch off, that if they show too much on the screen, then people will just switch off and the ratings go down and they get it in the backside because the ratings have gone down. There's another thing called the compassion fatigue syndrome that happened in Vietnam and it happened in Ulster, that the more and more you see of it, the more and more bored you get and less sympathetic you become and less of it you want to watch. Again, if you don't watch it, the ratings go down, and the editors are asked, why are the ratings down? They'd have to take all these into consideration. There's a hell of a lot in the formula.
Where were you at the end of the war, Michael? When, the Biafran War? Would you have been there right at the end?
No. No, I don't think anyone was there right at the end. I don't think there were any journalists in Biafra at the time, as far as I know, as far as I can remember. And of course, it ended very quickly. It ended much quicker than people expected it to. I mean, it'd been going on for, 2.5, 3 years? And then all of a sudden, we were alerted that the aid flights had stopped. That was the first signal that things had gone wrong. No more aid flights out of Sao Tome, Fernando Po. Then we got the alert that the Biafran army had retreated and was dispersing. And so we all kind of rushed out again to Sao Tome. And, the island was jam-packed with people. Most of them pilots, of course, who were just waiting to see what the next move was, having been denied further flights. They're all on the island, not knowing where to go and what to do next. And I think I must... See, it was very difficult. You couldn't... Because the aid flights had stopped, there were no flights to take you to Sao Tome. These were all organised by Caritas. So there was no way of getting there. And I think I must have flown to Lagos, then I went into Ghana, then I went... I mean, I moved all the way down the west coast of Africa, trying to get closer and closer to... or rather up Africa, up the coast of Africa, trying to get close to Nigeria, Biafra, and hoping perhaps to get into Biafra through the back door, all of which was in vain. And eventually we did end up in Sao Tome again, to hear that it was all over. So there was nobody, as far as I recollect, there was nobody in Biafra at the time of the collapse. And you may find that I'm wrong there, but certainly nobody that I know of, and the regular guys were there. I remember one guy, Ian Mather, of I think he was working for the Daily Mail at the time. He had gone through 13 countries to get to Sao Tome, 13 countries, and he arrived much after the rest of us, absolutely exhausted. And to be confronted with a cable from his office, which, as I remember, said, "Make like hell, Biafra boy, before Sunday's update with the emotional frontliner." That's all cablese, but you understand what it means. It absolutely devastated him. Anyway, we did our wrap-up stories in Sao Tome with the pilots going home, the place closing down, and that was the end of the Biafran War, and I never went there again. I never went to Nigeria again. Never wanted to.
This would have been your first experience of conflict, am I right? Of extreme conflict.
Well, I suppose Nigeria was my first experience of intense conflict. I mean, a few firefights on the way up to the final scene with the Biafran prisoner. It was my first... experience of death at close range, seeing that Biafran shot within a yard of me, being splattered with his blood. Nigeria was my first experience of seeing people slaughtered. So no, I think Nigeria was my first close contact with murder, killing, and, you know, intense suffering. But the most intense suffering came later in Biafra, when, as I said earlier, you were witnessing the slow starvation of children. But conflict on a grander scale, you know, had to wait till later. So it's mostly until Vietnam, Cambodia, many years later.
You'd had a couple of guns pointed at you there during this experience in Nigeria and Biafra. How did you feel at the end of it? Did you want more? Did you want to go into similar situations?
No, I didn't. I never want to. I never ever want to go through a Biafran situation again. Mostly because of the, the emotional upset. But I think I may have said to you that one of the reasons it was easier for me to cope with witnessing children suffering on that scale was the fact that I had none of my own. I went with a cameraman who had two small children at the time, and a sound recorder who also had children, and they found it very hard to cope because obviously they could identify. Because I had no children, it was easier for me to cope. I remember, again, referring back to Abavan, I think I was possibly the only member of our crews, and we had quite a few camera crews there, who was not crying on the day of the funeral, at least close to tears, because they all had children. And I was to discover much later, when I had children, how hard it is to cope watching the suffering of children when you have children of your own. So that in a way insulated me from the intense suffering that I would have experienced in Biafra had I had children of my own. And I suppose, in a way, the fact that I have been so concerned about kids in war since, is it may be that there was some kind of guilt complex that I didn't feel greater sympathy in those days. But I, again, as I said to you, the older you, the older I've got, and the more experience I've had, the harder it is to cope with it. Now, people think that the older you get, and the more you see, the harder you become, the more insulated, if you like, from it. But the reverse, in my case, is true. I know it's true. Whether it's with others, I don't know. But with me, the longer I've been in the business, and the more suffering I've seen, the harder it gets to cope with it.
Is that because with experience, you know, you empathise much more with a greater range of people, as you're saying, you know, with your own children, with young children, for instance? Is it a part of the maturing process, do you think?
I suppose a bit like a fruit, the more mature you become, the softer you become. I think also it's to do with, you know, one of the things that prompts you in the early days as a reporter is that you think that your typewriter, what you write, what you report, what your camera sees, will somehow, I mean, you feel like a young crusader, I think. You somehow feel that what you write, what you see, what you report is going to change things. I think we thought that in Biafra, that once people had seen these images of the dead and the dying, somehow the war would be brought to a quicker close. Things would be done. People wouldn't put up with it. And I think that helps. That's one of the things that inspires you, prompts you, encourages you to carry on. But when you get to my age and you start to hang up your boots, you realise that you've done nothing to cure the world of its ills. All you've done is to advertise them. And it's that sense of frustration, I think, that feeling of chronic inability that makes you softer. I think you realise that, you know, what is it all for? What is the point of me doing all this? Because nothing ever changes. In fact, things get kind of compounded. I think there is probably greater suffering in the world today than there was when I first started. So what have we journalists done to help things? We've done nothing, really. We've simply exposed the world's inability to cope, its illnesses, and we've done nothing to cure them. So I think that makes you jaundiced. There's no doubt that a journalist of any experience becomes jaundiced. He becomes cynical. He tries to cover it up in many ways. You often find an awful lot of journalists who've seen the worst things are the ones who joke most about it, because that's their way of that's their armour. But you won't find a journalist of any experience who isn't also a very jaundiced person. Stands to reason, doesn't it?
Yes, you have explained that very well. Would this have been a sort of high learning curve for you, the fact that you were living in very bad conditions and that you were facing danger? And, you know, it seems from what you have said that there were times when you could have disappeared in, you know, the sort of countryside, when you were out in Nigeria, for instance.
Oh, yes.
Did you learn a lot from that first experience in terms of survival?
I don't think I learned. I mean, I think I was probably surprised at my own ability to do things which I'd never have dreamt of doing before, like smuggling myself aboard an aircraft full of wounded soldiers in order to get our film back to Lagos. I mean, actually running out onto, I remember once running out onto the tarmac at Lagos Airport, you know, with a film bag in my hand, waving it to the pilot of the aircraft to take it. I mean, astonishing things you do to get your film home. It's a very precious piece of cargo.